The next matter on for oral argument this morning is Highland Management Group versus Joyce Moeller.
How tall was this guy?
He was wearing really thick shoes.
Guess so.
Counsel, as you're getting squared away, I'll just remind you of our rules. No, I'm not trying to rush you. Take your time in situating yourselves. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for respondent will also have 15 minutes, but counsel for appellant will get an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you would choose to use that time after the respondent's argument in chief. The timing restrictions are indicated in the podium, so please be mindful of the clock, and state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep track of who's making which argument in our oral recording of the proceedings. Whenever you are ready to proceed, counsel for appellant, you may.
Thank you and good morning. My name is Christopher Kalla. I represent Highland Management Group, the appellant. This appeal is from an eviction bench trial from Hennepin County Housing Court. The tenant prevailed. The housing court issued a conditional reasonable accommodation allowing the tenant to stay in possession. Landlord appealed directly to the Court of Appeals. There was no intermediate judicial review per Rule 611 of the housing court rules. Landlord is asking this court to reverse the order of the housing court referee and award possession to the landlord. Procedurally, subsequent to that first eviction, there was a second eviction based off of a violation of the conditional reasonable accommodation ordered by the referee in the first eviction.
In other words, Ms. Moeller is no longer in the apartment.
Actually, she is. The landlord prevailed in that second eviction, and the tenant availed herself of Rule 611 judicial review. That has been briefed and argued. It is currently under advisement. Ms. Moeller is currently still in possession of the apartment.
So this other eviction is ongoing below?
Yes.
Okay.
It is not yet at the Court of Appeals.
Got it.
And I don't know what the deadline is for that
and
decision.
Is it your position that that other proceeding has any bearing on how we address the issues in this case?
Slightly. One of the issues in this case is the impact of whether or not the condition of the apartment of Ms. Moeller constitute a direct threat. I believe it's the tenant's position that the condition of the apartment has sufficiently improved during the pendency of the notice given on October 17th and the trial that happened after February 28th. We take the position that, in fact, the condition of the apartment had not sufficiently improved, and by way of the second eviction's findings of fact.
Had not improved by what, until what, before what time? Before the proceedings or before, in this case?
The landlord takes a position that in eviction one, which occurred after holdover, after February 28th, that as of the trial date.
In this case. Right.
And that trial date's gonna be relevant based off of the Schuett analysis, that by the trial date in eviction one, the conditions of the apartment had not sufficiently improved to the point where, even under Schuett, that the tenant had cured the material defect. And by way of example, we show that in the second eviction, the same referee, making similar findings, demonstrated that the tenant had failed several subsequent inspections of the apartment. And so we take the position that bolsters the landlord's conclusion of error in the first eviction. I'm sorry, not of error per se, but of the tenant's position that the apartment had improved. We don't believe it had. We believe it was error then for the court to grant the reasonable accommodation. We believe the direct threat analysis.
I'm not sure that I'm following how this. We're reviewing your appeal from the housing court findings of fact, conclusions of law, or for judgment of April 3rd or 4th, depending on whether you count the date of signing or the date of the judgment, right?
Yes.
Can we, in examining that and without a motion that would supplement the record, look beyond the file and the file contents as of that date?
I would concede it's irregular for the court to consider that, but I don't think there's any dispute as to what that record shows. And I'm not offering it to justify, I'm not asking this court to evict Ms. Mueller based off of the second eviction.
Put another way, can we look at facts that weren't even in existence at the time that this order was made in order to find that this order should be reversed?
I believe that the consistency of the second eviction findings with the first evictions of findings is simply offered to show that the tenant's position of what they believe the findings showed, that there had been an improvement, is incorrect. And I know, I appreciate the irregularity in that, and I've never had an occasion to be presented with this situation before.
Let me switch gears here. I think we can maybe talk about that or look at that further, but I'm a little concerned with the argument that there is no defense to an end of lease eviction in the case of a tenant who suffers from a disability under the law. You argue, I think, that we should, in essence, make Kleinman the law in Minnesota by published opinion.
That's fair. And I believe that's also consistent with the Douglas versus Creeksfield case. That's the Court of Appeals case from D.C. Court of Appeals en banc 2005. Tenants cite that in passing. In footnote 56.
I'll make a note and look back at it later. Footnote 56 in which case?
Douglas versus Creeksfield.
Got it.
And I'm just going to read the first sentence of footnote 56. By applying federal fair housing law to require a reasonable accommodation if requested prior to eviction, we in no way modify local law that enables the landlord to sue for possession upon expiration of the notice to cure or quit. And that footnote is following a passage in Creeksfield that in essence is embodying the Schuett rule. And the Schuett rule, if I may, basically says in a breach case, a tenant who cures the breach prior to the date of trial under a reasonable accommodation construct is allowed to stay. I don't think Schuett was properly decided, but I don't need to have this court overturn Schuett to reach the decision the landlord is asking for, because this case is holdover. Schuett was a breach case. Creeksfield was a breach case. And Creeksfield explicitly says, we're not suggesting that in a holdover case that the reasonable accommodation defense would also apply. And the facts of Creeksfield and the facts of Schuett are very similar. Both breach cases, both subsidized properties. And in Creeksfield, Creeksfield has lots of issues going on. The landlord knew about the reasonable accommodation request prior to the trial date. There was time to cure. There's lots of issues in Creeksfield and Schuett that are basically really similar. But to say today that Creeksfield says that the direct threat should be allowed to play itself out under the guise of what reasonable accommodation the tenant was requesting before we deem the reasonable accommodation unreasonable, I believe is improper.
Well, what if a landlord, near the conclusion of the tenant's lease, I'm not talking about this case right now, I'm talking about as a general principle. What if the landlord said the tenant was in a wheelchair and needed some accommodation, I can't even think of what it might be, but some accommodation. And as the lease is coming to an end, the landlord says, I'm going to let the lease expire and I'm not going to renew your lease because I'm not going to put up with this.
Put up with what?
Requests for accommodation for a wheelchair.
Well, that could be deemed retaliatory.
So it would only be retaliatory, it wouldn't be a fair housing violation?
Well, I think it would be a fair housing violation because it is retaliatory, but the facts are different here. We don't have Ms. Moeller asking for a reasonable accommodation prior to the landlord giving notice, prior to the landlord filing suit.
Fair enough. Now I follow your reasoning. Let's just take a slightly different set of facts. The accommodation is made to the person in the wheelchair. The lease is coming to an end, and the landlord says, I'm not going to renew the the lease. I made the accommodation. I'm not going to do it in the future. We're going to end this thing.
I still think, then, if the reasoning behind the non-renewal is based off of the response to the tenant's request for the accommodation, that presents a retaliation defense and a fair housing issue.
Okay. What about a disability, the wheelchair, but there's been no request for accommodation? The landlord says, I'm just not going to have people with a wheelchair leasing here. We're not going to renew that lease.
If that's what the landlord says, that's a problem for the landlord. You can't do that.
Under?
If his reasoning is, I don't want to have wheelchair people in my building.
It's a fair housing law violation.
He is discriminating on the basis of a disability. And the issue is different.
That's a defense that can be made in an eviction proceeding.
So for a holdover case.
Is that yes or no? So that is a defense, I'm asking you. In that circumstance, is that a defense that can be raised in an eviction proceeding?
So I take the position that a tenancy can be terminated for any reason or no reason, just not an illegal reason. And if the tenant can demonstrate that the reason that the landlord is giving is because animus towards them based off of a protected status, that protected status being gender, familial status, a disability, public assistance. Yes. That's problematic.
So and you're saying it can be a defense.
It would be an affirmative defense, and I think the tenant would have to demonstrate. And we have issues regarding the timing of, you know, the 90-day look-back provision. If a tenant makes a claim and within 90 days they suffer an adverse action, increase in rent,
and that wasn't
non-renewal.
It wasn't found in this case or argued in this case, as I read the record, that your client made the decision to end the lease because of a disability.
It was not because of the disability. It was because of the condition of the apartment.
No, I understand that's your position, but I just want to be clear about what was going on in the district court before the referee. It was not alleged by by Ms. Moeller or found by the referee that your client made the decision to evict based upon a disability.
Correct. I mean, I use the phrase animus. I don't think there was any animus either alleged or found. Correct. The connection that the tenant was making was that the landlord's characterization of the issue of why they want to non-renew is based off of the condition of the apartment. The condition of the apartment is related to her disability. Ergo, connect the dots, the notice of non-renewal is based off the disability. The problem we have with that is there's no causal nexus between the state of disability, which is physical, and the actual condition of the apartment.
And there's no just to be clear, there was no finding that there was a causal relationship.
I don't believe there was. I mean, that's the allegation. I mean, yes, I would agree with you. Somebody who is disabled, physically disabled, may have a difficult time cleaning up their apartment. That's what happened in Schuett. But the issues we have in this case, turning off your refrigerator, not calling for help, refusing inspections. I mean, the sink was overflowing. And again, I rarely append the record with exhibits from the trial, but the four photographs clearly show this is not like the photograph the amicus puts in with the old lady standing beside the pile of boxes wondering, what am I going to do? That's not the condition of this apartment. The landlord couldn't even enter the apartment. They went there to check on a leaky sink from the next door neighbor, seeing if they were connected. They couldn't even reach the kitchen. And when they did, they found the refrigerator turned off, the sink was overflowing with water, the refrigerator was oozing.
The referee found, and I'll quote here on page 7 of the decision, landlord only allowed tenant 2 days to cure her default after they had notice of the unsanitary condition of her apartment. I just wonder, is that an accurate characterization of the timing of the opportunity to cure?
Well, that's an accurate presentation of the timing of the events, but it's a mischaracterization of what was going on with the landlord. On October 15th, they find out the condition of the apartment. they assess it, and on October 17th, they realize this is not going to work. We are going to give this tenant a notice to non-renew. The landlord could have given a notice of breach and filed immediately for eviction. They chose not to. They gave the
That was like 4 months prior to the termination.
Yes, and if you compare the timing of Schuett, which was 49 days between the date of notice and the trial date, wherein it was cured, and this case, where it was like 149 days, three times as much time, and there wasn't a cure. I mean, the tenant was not arguing at trial, we've cured the problem. In fact, the evidence from the landlord demonstrates the tenant during those 4 months was in denial about the condition of her apartment. She was saying, I didn't do anything wrong. I don't want you inspecting my apartment. She wasn't reaching out for help to the landlord. What can you do to assist me to get this place cleaned up before the trial date, before the end of my lease? I mean, had she done that, again, I don't like the Schuett decision, but if you apply Schuett, the trial court would have found that had the apartment been cleaned up by the trial date, she cured the breach. And then we can talk about footnote 56 in Kriegsfeld, whether or not that defense analysis should apply in a holdover case. But we don't have that. We don't have a cured defect prior to trial. And that alone, I believe, makes Schuett inapplicable. I mean, the landlord gave the tenant several follow-up notices and was met with defiance. And I want to jump to finding of fact 40 in Referee Labine's decision. He talks about how the tenant requested reasonable additional time to clean the apartment. Our position is the tenant requested more time to vacate, to finance her move out, not to clean the apartment. And the only record that Referee Labine cites to is the findings of fact that were proposed by the tenant. There's no record that I can see where the tenant requested more time of the landlord to clean her apartment before the trial date. I mean, it gets put in the answer, but prior to that, we don't believe the record supports a finding that the tenant actually made a request for more time to clean her apartment.
Thank you.
Thank
Your
you.
Time has expired. You will have 15 minutes, or 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Yeah, we could be here all day, I suppose, but you get 5 more minutes and that's it. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Stillman from Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. I represent Ms. Joyce Muller, the tenant, in this appeal of an eviction action for holdover. Ms. Muller prevailed below when referee Mark Labine concluded that appellant failed to reasonably accommodate Ms. Muller's disabilities under the Fair Housing Act by refusing to renew her lease. This court should affirm this correct and just result.
What was Ms. Muller's disability?
Ms. Muller has many physical limitations that the court found readily apparent. She has difficulty walking. She has difficulty lifting things. She has osteoporosis in her hips that makes it difficult for her to bend over.
But what was her disability? I'm trying to get a sense of when the landlord would have been put on notice that your client had a disability under the as defined by the ADA.
So I would point the court to paragraphs 35 and 36 of the court order, where the court finds that her disabilities are readily apparent. According to the Department of Housing and Urban Development and Department of Justice joint statement on reasonable accommodations, if disabilities are readily apparent, the person, tenant, does not need to provide direct proof that they are disabled.
You have to have some, it has to be apparent that there's a handicap, meaning there's a substantial limit to one or more major life activity. What did the referee find to be the major life activity that was substantially limited?
That she has difficulty walking, that she's frail. I mean, if you look at substantial life activities, the definition is incredibly broad, and it does include things like bending over, walking, ability to dress yourself. and the like.
Right, and when did the referee find that your client had a substantial limit to any particular major life activity?
He didn't use the direct words that she had limits necessarily. He didn't use the exact words the judge referenced.
What are the words that you can point to from which we can infer that a proper finding has been made that your client has a disability, assuming that your client can raise the disability defense in the setting that we have here in a holdover case?
The court found that she has a disability in paragraphs 35. In paragraph 35, he said that Ms. Muller is disabled and would qualify for protection under the Fair Housing Act due to her physical condition and abilities.
Well, there was she used a walker, appears frail, and the horrendous condition of her apartment should have made it readily apparent to landlord the tenant had severe physical restrictions to her ability to move about and not clean her apartment. That, I think, is the extent of the description in paragraph 35.
Oh, then I apologize. It would be paragraph 36.
36 is the legal conclusion that tenant is disabled.
Yes. So that is where the referee made the finding that Ms. Muller is disabled based on her appearance and the physical limitations that he found in the order.
I'm just trying to get a sense of how, I gather you think that would be sufficient. If you had a trial on the ADA itself, if this were an ADA trial or a trial under the MHRA, and the argument is that your client was disabled, your view is that it would be enough to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that your client is disabled, that she used a walker and is frail and has a unsanitary apartment. That's enough to prove a disability.
I would argue yes, Your Honor. That was a finding of fact that the court made partially based on her appearance at trial. This court should give substantial deference to that finding of fact.
Can we agree that with the finding that she used a walker and that she appeared frail and her apartment was unsanitary, what is the strongest case law that you were able to identify to establish that that is a basis to find by a preponderance of the evidence a disability?
I would point the court to Schuett. I would point the court to the Douglas case that counsel mentioned previously. I would point the court to the joint statement as well by the Department of Housing and Development and the Department of Justice. I listed other case law in the brief. Some would be Roe v. Sugar River, and again, there is other case law mentioned in my brief that would support that position.
I didn't see anything in your brief that would support the conclusion that or make the argument that that is enough under the case law interpreting the statutes for disability, that would be enough to establish handicap or disability under any of those, any of the statutes that might define a disability or handicap.
That her, and I apologize, that her physical limitations would be enough to qualify her as disabled under the Fair Housing Act. I would say that because of how the Fair Housing Act defines disability, the court's finding that she is obviously disabled would be sufficient to put her under that category of being disabled. That would make Schuett applicable, make Douglas applicable. Also, the fact that Ms. Cruz, the property manager, found her to be considered her to be a hoarder is enough to put Ms. Muller under the protections of the Fair Housing Act as well. The Fair Housing Act does include perception that somebody is disabled as sufficient to put them into the protected class of disabled persons for purposes of the Fair Housing Act.
How does the long line of cases that establish and the statute that establishes an eviction proceeding as a summary proceeding, how is it that consistent with the allowing for the reasonable accommodations defense to be made in a holdover case where the accommodation request didn't occur until, as I understand the record, until your client was represented by counsel and provided an answer to the eviction notice or the eviction proceeding?
Well, I would first like to note that we believe it was sufficient based on the obvious connection of her disabilities and the condition of her apartment that she requested more time to clean. Ms. Cruz again admitted that Ms. Mueller made this request, and that is on page 37 of the transcripts in lines 3 through 5. Ms. Mueller also testified that she made these requests on page 113 of the transcript, line 7 through page 114, line 13.
I'm basing on the finding of the referee. The only request, and this is paragraph 40, the only request made by tenant prior to this eviction action was a request to landlord in October to give her additional time to clean her apartment and a request on February 26 to give her until August 29 to move. I think that was the finding of the referee. You're not challenging...
I'm not challenging what the referee put in his order. I would just point the court to those paragraphs. It is also our position that Ms. Mueller can request a reasonable accommodation at any point until the writ has been issued. That would be consistent, we believe, with landlord-tenant law, where a tenant has a right to raise defenses to remain in possession of the property, and Eighth Circuit and other case law that states that a reasonable accommodation is a proper defense to an eviction action. And again, that is consistent with the Schuett holding.
So what's your position on appeal? Are you saying that the request made in October was a reasonable request for an accommodation?
We are, and then we would also state that the request in the answer and the request made in the first appearance would also be sufficient.
So the request was made in October for more time. More time than what?
Well, and that can't be determined, Your Honor, because the point, the whole issue that began this process is that landlord entered her apartment on October 16th. On October 17th, they gave her a notice of not lease non-renewal that day.
Right, but she requested more time to clean the apartment. And the eviction before the end of her lease, which wouldn't occur until February. So it's October, November, December, January. So how much time, based upon your client's disability, would be a reasonable accommodation to allow her to arrange for her apartment to be cleaned?
And that was never able to be determined because the landlord failed to engage in the interactive process with her, as is required by law.
Let's assume the landlord did engage in the interactive process. How much time do you think would be sufficient, beyond which it would no longer be reasonable?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. Reasonable accommodations are determined on a case-by-case basis.
But we're talking about cleaning up an apartment, maybe on a case-by-case basis, but if the accommodation is, I just want time to clean my apartment, or I presume to have it cleaned since she couldn't clean her apartment herself, how much time is reasonable to allow a person to arrange to have an apartment cleaned?
I wouldn't want to speculate on that, Your Honor.
3 months be reasonable?
Again, it depends on the circumstances.
Circumstances of this case?
Potentially, it depends. Services take an extraordinarily long time to be set up. And the point is that...
Cleaning services? To have someone clean takes...
Cleaning services, services through the county, services through doctors' organizations. But the point is that the landlord failed to ever discuss these options with her. They immediately issued the lease non-renewal and never veered from that perspective. So it was a foregone conclusion that they were going to have her out of the property. They didn't ask her about how much more time she needed to clean. And we believe that in and of itself is a violation of the Fair Housing Act.
As a matter of the facts in this case, she would have had time to clean between the October notice and the time of the eviction notice, and she would have had time to clean between the notice and the eviction trial.
And there are findings that her apartment improved. The court made findings. The landlord wrote in a letter that conditions had improved. Ms. Mueller provided picture evidence that the conditions of her apartment had improved. But I would point the court back to the fact that this non-renewal in and of itself that created the action for holdover is discriminatory because it was given for a discriminatory reason. So
I didn't see that.
October.
The one, yes, the non-renewal that was provided on October 17th.
Now, the district or the referee did not find, and I didn't see that it was argued, that that this was a retaliatory or discriminatory purpose in issuing the October notice. Am I wrong about the record in that regard?
We did not argue that the notice was retaliatory. We did argue that it was discriminatory.
And the referee found what in regard to that? Was there ever a finding that the notice was given in October for discriminatory purposes?
The court never used the word discriminatory in his findings. However, by making this connection, by pointing out that this connection is obvious, that this non-renewal was obviously related to her disabilities, that the only way for the tenant to remain in the leased property is if the landlord provides her with a reasonable accommodation that would allow her an opportunity to seek outside help, we believe is sufficient to show that this was a discriminatory lease non-renewal. The landlord never provided any reasons why, other than the condition of the apartment, why they were refusing to renew her lease. So it was based on the condition of the apartment, which was obviously connected to her disability. And recently, the 11th Circuit and 4th Circuit have both found that notices of lease non-renewal, if issued for a discriminatory reason, should be considered void. So
right. I don't think that's in dispute in Minnesota either, but I didn't see a finding that the referee concluded that the reason for the notice in October was because of a disability that your client had or a perceived disability, but that it was because the client because of the condition of the home. What is the finding that you would point to by the referee that would support your suggestion that the referee, in fact, found that the landlord's motive, was discriminatory or retaliatory?
I just ran out of time.
Sure did, but you can answer my question.
Okay. I would point the court to paragraphs 43 through 50. The court's findings are not neat by any means, so unfortunately I would have to point to multiple paragraphs for the court to interpret that that was the reason for the non-renewal. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry. We're going to keep you and hold you there for just a few more moments.
Oh, okay.
I'm looking at those very findings, and it seems like that the housing court was finding that the reason was that there was, it was cluttered and there were dishes in the sink, and although it was improved by March 19th, it continued to be a bad, unsanitary, smelly situation. That's the way I read those findings.
That her apartment had not
improved a little bit.
Improved a little bit.
Right, but I didn't see anything about discrimination or retaliation or anything like that. It still all relates to the condition of the apartment, and maybe she needs some help to make it cleaner.
Yes, which again, I believe, goes back to the fact that the reason for the non-renewal is the condition of her apartment, which is related to the disability. So even if the referee did not use those exact words, the referee, by finding that, by discussing the condition of the apartment, that she should be allowed to have more time to clean her apartment, I think implies that that would be the reason for the lease non-renewal.
Thank you. I think we understand.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Your argument? Counsel for appellant.
I do agree with Ms. Stillman that the reason for the non-renewal was the condition of the apartment. But to then make the connection that the condition of the apartment was had a causal nexus to her disability, that's where the analysis falls short in this defense.
I couldn't find in the record any suggestion that the refrigerator being turned off has anything to do with her disability.
And that's the point I'm trying to make. I mean,
did the refrigerator work?
Yes, it did.
How did it get turned off?
I don't know. I mean, I suspect that the reality here is that Ms. Moeller may have some mental disabilities. But that wasn't argued, that wasn't pled, that wasn't litigated at all. It was just her physical disability. And that's the limitation of the defense here. And that's the limitation of our investigation as to whether there's a nexus between that claimed physical disability and the manifestation that we see in her apartment, the overflowing sink, the open refrigerator with oozing with food, being turned off, not calling for assistance, refusing inspections. None of those are related to a physical disability. I mean, the record shows Ms. Moeller drives herself to court. I mean, she may use a walker, but she's not an invalid.
Is it a walker? I was confused about that because I saw some reference to her using a cart. What kind of cart is that?
So I think it's a cart slash walker. I think it's the same device.
It's not a shopping cart.
Little devices that roll, and then they have a little seat on them if you need to sit down.
Oh, in a basket, I suppose.
Okay. That's the inference that I draw, right. Yes. So I think that's the same.
Somehow I had a shopping cart in my mind, and I thought that was an unusual thing to bring to court. But
it's not an unusual thing to see in apartment buildings. People use shopping carts for transporting goods up and down. If I could direct the court's attention to paragraph 46 on page 7 of Referee Levine's findings, the photos presented on March 19th by the tenant after the holdover date showed that the apartment was still in a cluttered condition. Notwithstanding the fact that the landlord may acknowledge some improvement during that time from October 15th forward, the condition of the apartment was still improper.
Well, I know there's a difference between clutter and what I see in the photographs at the time that the refrigerator had been turned. Clutter is there's stuff laying where it isn't put away. The photos seem to suggest something significantly beyond clutter, and then by March 19th, we're talking about clutter.
Sure, and we also have, in October, we have the smell in the apartment.
Right, that's what I'm saying. That sounds like there may be rotting food, there may be a thing that is a legitimate safety problem for other people in the an unsafe arrangement for her and everyone else, but clutter, I don't know.
Well, that mitigates.
My wife doesn't like where I put my shoes sometimes either, and that qualifies as clutter.
Well, I'm not going to evict you, Your Honor, but I mean, we have the smell in October, and then we have the smell coming back in January. I mean, this is not a situation where we see a downward path towards really bad, towards something that's passable. And that's like I said, in the second eviction, we have Referee Levine finding the property is still not meeting the standards. And that's the basis for the holdover. And I talk about...
I had asked earlier whether it had been argued or found that the motive for the eviction was discriminatory. And you had said it wasn't argued or found. Counsel for Ms. Moeller says it was argued and found.
Amicus makes the argument that there was discrimination. I don't think there was
I'm talking about what was argued and what was found for the referee. What's your position as to whether Ms. Moeller argued that the reason for the notice to quit was out of a discriminatory purpose?
I don't believe there was any argument by the tenant that the landlord's motivation was animus towards her status as somebody who is disabled. It was based off of the condition of the apartment. The cases that she talks about, perception of disability, those types of things. Judge Rodenberg, that's more akin to our opening dialogue about a landlord's animus towards people who use wheelchairs. I just don't like them. Yes, that's the perception. Or I perceive somebody as disabled. I don't want those kinds of people in my apartment building. That's the kind of case law that the tenant's argument is based off of, not the manifestation of what we see here. The tenant is asking for fundamental alteration of the landlord's program, and that is the ability at the end of a lease to give a notice of non-renewal consistent with 504B 285 subdivision 1A3 and 504B 135, which is the termination of tenancies at will. To give the tenant their argument would mean that anybody who can claim a disability gets to be a tenant forever. In a market rate property, that is not the law.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your argument. Thank you for your written submissions as well as your oral presentation today. We have taken the matter under advisement, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.